I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, it's Lainey.
Hey, it's Joanna.
Welcome to Show Your Work.
It is another special episode that we are super excited about.
Yes, we have a special guest, a very special guest, at a very special time.
Yeah, absolutely. Our special guest is Michael Grassi, who is a writer and executive producer on Riverdale, and I'm also proud to say a dear friend of mine. We met years ago on a little Canadian show called Degrassi.
Mm-hmm. You've just name-checked Riverdale and Degrassi, and you haven't even, like, mentioned the big news.
No, I was going to leave that for you. I'm generous.
So Michael is now, fresh news, the executive producer of Katie Keene.
Katie Keene, another spinoff of the Riverdale franchise, like Sabrina, which is coming to the CW this fall.
So just to be clear, everybody, we have a proper showrunner today as our guest.
And he is talking to us all about writing and being a Canadian in the U.S. and the thirst traps of writing for very, very hot teens.
And he's talking about fan service, writer life.
And he had one kind of rule for getting through long 16-hour production days that mm-hmm. you really, really loved.
I'm going to make that into a t-shirt. But also, he like fed into what you know to be, and I want everybody else to, you know, join me on this, is he like allowed me to develop and increase and feed my fetish for the writer's room.
And there's a good reason for that. It's pretty awesome. My favorite thing was that there are lessons and experiences he and I had together that are still really resonant. So it's not only gratifying to think we both remember the same things, but to remind you all that the people that you came up in the trenches with, some very nice trenches, are often the ones who really understand the way that you think and the way that frame your outlook on work.
And because I'm a narcissist, and I want to join this Degrassi party. I was a guest star in one of the movies. I'm not going to say star. I was a guest cameo.
Well, that's true.
You wrote the movie.
Michael and I and two other writers, Kate Melville and Emily Andrus, now the showrunner of Wynonna Earp, if we're name dropping,
yep,
wrote four episodes that were also billed as a TV movie called Degrassi Takes Manhattan. And you make an appearance in it.
Yes.
As yourself.
I have a line or two.
We should probably find that clip and link it in the show notes.
Anyway, it was such a treat to have Michael with us. All season, we've been profiling the work of writers of in different industries. And to be able to talk to a showrunner, somebody who has been in a writer's room, and who's gone from being a member of the writer's room to leading a writer's room, the progression of his career, showing his work, it's really such an honor for us to be able to showcase that.
So listen to your friend and mine, Michael Grassi, and we'll meet you on the other side.
Hi, Michael.
Hi.
This is so fun. I'm just going to institute this as the way that I hang out with my friends. Just like, come on the podcast.
I'm so excited to be here. And I don't know if you guys know this, but I'm just going to say it anyway. You guys have so many fans. And when I mentioned to a friend that I was doing this, she literally said, "Oh my God," for 30 seconds straight and started referencing all of your episodes. So you guys have a lot of fans, just so you know. I'm so excited to be here and honored.
Is this your first ever podcast?
This is my second ever podcast. I did one for Riverdale season one, which was really fun. And so I feel really warmed up. It's been 3 years. So we're just jumping back in.
And of course, you live with a podcaster who has a super, super popular podcast.
Yes, Matt I'm in actually in his office right now. So if we're on Skype, so you can see over my shoulder his Jennifer Aniston calendar, I think, right around here. But he hasn't asked me to be a guest yet. Maybe one day. I'm waiting.
I mean, that's the real pinnacle, right?
I'm hoping. It's called Homophilia. I'm going to plug it. And it's really, really good. They interview LGBT celebs. And I haven't reached celeb status yet. But maybe that's why I haven't gotten my invite.
Well, look at that for an intro. So I think you're about to reach full-on celeb status. So we mentioned in the intro, but you have been the co-EP for Riverdale for several seasons, and you are just about to start production as we speak on Katie Keene for the CW. True? False?
True. All true. No, it's been really fun. It's funny when you join a show in season one, you really don't know what it's going to be or what the ride's going to be. And it's been really, really exciting to tell the stories and to see the kids sort of blow up and become huge stars. And we're headed into season four with a lot of the same writers that we started with in season one, a really strong team, maybe one of the best rooms I've ever worked with, such strong writers. And in this last year, in season three, Roberto and I started developing Katie together, and we made a pilot, and that just got picked up this past week. And it's very, very exciting.
So now that we have you here, I mean, there's so much to talk about because we're so lucky. We scheduled this a few weeks ago, and then it just happens that we talk to you when the news breaks. So we feel like we have an exclusive here. But also, we are in the room, so to speak, with somebody who is on the ground in LA over the last few months while this whole writer's agent break kind of battle is going on. So what's it been like on the ground in LA, like in the hub of where the majority of art writers live and work? As a writer yourself, how has the atmosphere been?
Well, it's kind of been a complicated time and a very emotional time, I think. I think a lot of us have strong relationships with our agents. I think a lot of us feel close to our agents, and our agents really helped us in our careers. And then there's also a really important fight that has to be done, that has to happen. And we're standing with the writers, and it's complicated, and it's emotional, and it's also a time when staffing is happening. So we want to make sure that we're seeing everybody who's out there when we're trying to staff a room up. And usually we're liaising with agents to make that happen. But it's been amazing to see a community of writers sort of rally and support each other. And we've met with many writers who were recommended online or on Twitter, or people who we met through our executives at Berlanti did some deep digging. And we sort of got ahead of it knowing that this was coming. But it's been nice to see writers sort of rally and have each other's backs and support each other through this agentless time, which is new, uncharted territory. And I guess my personal hope is that everyone sort of gets back to the table soon and figures something out so that we can all either get back with the agents that we love or find new ones, but we can sort of proceed as business as usual. So everyone can get back to work is sort of how I'm feeling. Well, what have you guys been hearing? What's your take on it?
I mean, so what we know is obviously, I think it's a really good point that you point out, like the unions and the union sort of positions are what are in opposition, but individual writers and reps really, of course, care for each other and have like helped each other's careers over this time. The interesting thing, it's been amazing to watch the staffing on Twitter, as you say, for those who don't follow a bunch of writers, a lot of writers are putting up notices saying, I need, you know, a writer at such and such a level for this genre of show, and people respond. Or people saying, hi, I'm a co-producer level and I just got off this show, call me for interviews. And I love hearing from you that it's actually happening. And I guess the other thing that we're hearing is that the press is maybe not super evenly weighted because, you know, for various reasons. But it's interesting to hear you say that you've really found that that sort of grassroots thing is working.
Well, I want to jump on that too. Like, part of my job is to be, I think, like, analyze the media. And so the coverage of this, which I'm interested in because I think you guys have maybe an insider perspective on what's going on and clearly, like, are on side with writers, the right side. But the layman out there, people who are just enjoying TV shows and not really understanding what the situation is, they're going to consume the news from media outlets. And it's been interesting to see which outlets are presenting the situation fairly, accurately, and which you, if you have an understanding and have connections in the world, you can see right away which media outlets are a little bit mouthpiecing on behalf of the agents. But I don't know if you don't have that sensibility, you don't know writers, you don't communicate with them, if you're reading those outlets, if you're going to, your takeaway is going to be, oh, these guys are embedded with the agents, their view is slanted. And so I'm curious, I worry about what that does to, you know, somebody who's not versed in the world.
Right, like, because it, you assume that an outlet that you trust is fairly unbiased or whatever.
Sure, and whether or not out there people are like, fuck, these writers, what are they complaining about? It's peak TV, there's TV shows everywhere, everybody should have a job. Like, you know, every time I turn on the Netflix, every time I, like, think about Amazon Prime, there's something new coming on. I don't understand what's happening.
Yeah, it's you're absolutely right. I think that reading the news can sometimes create fear and confusion, and as, wait, this isn't really what's happening. And there's been a lot of that, and there's been a lot of me having to personally talk to as many people as possible. I feel like that's, yeah. and not just people who I'm working with. Like, it's one thing to sort of talk to my agents or my lawyer, but it's another thing to talk to other writers. It's one thing to pick up the phone and talk to lawyers at the WGA. It's one thing to talk to representatives at the WGA. Honestly, talking to other writers and everybody, all of the people I just mentioned, has helped me make decisions for myself moving forward, and not just reading one outlet. Not that anybody's doing that, but sometimes you do open for instance Deadline, and you're like, oh my god, is this really what's going on? As a lot of us do, we often open Deadline once twice a day and read what's going on, and that's, I don't think that. That is always helpful.
You know what is helpful, though, I think, for fans like who don't have the insider perspective, is that business is, as you're talking about, going on as usual. Like, as opposed to, when was the strike? 2008?
Yeah.
Yeah. As opposed to in 2008, when there was an actual stoppage and things weren't moving forward. As we just heard from you, you're trying to staff a room, you're moving ahead, congratulations, the pilot, and then, you know, the series, things, work is continuing. And so I don't know necessarily that, I mean, fans only get upset when it actually affects their, like, their consume, like, their ability to consume the art, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right, they don't necessarily won't feel this, because what it is about ultimately is who's making money off those deals that are made and who's packaging or otherwise benefiting in ways that aren't necessarily what their clients,
yeah,
who, you know, who make them their commissions, signed on for.
And for them, it's like, as long as I get to watch TV, as long as I get to see, when is Katie King coming on?
Right, so, right, right. Yeah.
Right?
I think that's exactly right. I think when this was happening, some of the fear that was being put out there was, if you guys go on this strike, if you guys sort of do the sign this letter to let your agents go if they don't sign, I think a lot of the fear that was going around was, well, you guys won't get through staffing season. And I think people have successfully or are getting through staffing season. I think that the next thing that's being said is, well, you won't get through development season. And I do see that there will be challenges ahead, but it'll be interesting to see how far people will continue to get in this agentless world. And like I said, my hope is that people go to the table and start discussing again and do resolve this. Like I said, I like my agents. I want to keep working with them. hopefully in time.
So, okay. So let's talk a little bit then about staffing. So you are staffing up a room. You said, oh, Riverdale is one of the best rooms I've been in. You and I were in a wonderful room together for some many years. So talk a little bit for people who don't know, what is it that you're looking for? How do you put together a room?
That's such a good question. I think the top goal is a room full of diverse, passionate voices is the biggest thing. The sort of amazing thing about a room is you get to have this ongoing dinner conversation that goes on for a very, very long time, like 9 to 10 months or more, where these stories sort of accumulate and you get to hear from 10 people who have different perspectives in life and come from different places. And I think that's what's amazing. And whenever I sort of think about am I looking for a writer? What is Roberto looking for? And we're looking for people who are really passionate, and we're looking for people who are just there to make these stories with us and just contribute in every single way, whether that's a huge season-long arc idea, whether that's a great pitch for a conflict, a great scene, a great way into a scene, a great line of dialogue, an image. We're sort of looking for it all, and we need it all. It's a writer's room is a very special thing. And like I said, I love writers. So even this part of the year when I get to meet other writers, because when you're in it and you're kind of in a bubble and you're making a show. But when that sort of slows down and you get to step out and sort of meet with writers, that's a nice time as well. I love meeting with writers.
What does it feel like? Is it like dating?
I think maybe something like that. I think a big part of it too is you're spending so much time with these people. So I think a big part of the meeting is this someone that you want to spend a full year with making these stories with? And I think that is one part of it. And are they passionate? Are they excited to tell these stories? Are they passionate about the characters? And a big part of it as well, as you can imagine, is their material and their writing. And I love reading people, and I love seeing the different voices. And it's funny how you, Linda sort of said this to us, Duane, a while back, or we sort of figured that she did this, but you sort of cast a room, right? Like there's sort of like different people fill different sort of character voices and character places. Like you sort of understand, okay, well, this person, not that anybody's pigeonholed, but it's like, well, this person's going to come in and is sort of going to represent maybe this type of character. And obviously that ends up changing and evolving. And everyone on Riverdale, I would say, can write any character, but you do sort of cast a room to make sure that you have different voices contributing in different ways. And I do hear what you're saying. It is a little bit like maybe it's like dating. Maybe it's like seeing, like, do I want to spend a lot of time with this person is part of it for sure.
Well, Duanna knows I have a little bit of a fetish for writer's rooms. Whenever she's in a room and it's a new room, I always like love the stories. I want her to break down for me what it feels like, because I've never been in a writer's room. I haven't yet. I think that it's the same for the people listening. So I just want to explore this a little bit. This is when you talk about being together for 9 or 10 months with these people, it means being together vulnerable, like in a place of vulnerability, right? You are talking about the characters, talking about the story, but in order to get there, you're sharing a lot of yourself. Yes.
I think so. I think every room is different, and everyone's different in a room. I think some people share more personal experiences, some people less. And I think both versions of that is okay. But to that point, I think a room, all the best rooms that I've been in have been really rooms where you feel really safe. Rooms where you can pitch the bad idea, and the bad idea often leads to something great. And you sort of feel like you can be yourself and say the thing that you need to say whenever you need to say it. I think those are the best rooms that I've been in, where it sort of feels collaborative, and you can be vulnerable and you can open up about life experiences, because so many, especially on character shows like Riverdale and I think like Katie Keene, the stories will be really personal. So I think a room where people feel safe to open up is really, really important for sure.
Well, I think it's really indicative of your personality that you describe it as a dinner party conversation. Like, I think that says more about you than, because that's the kind of person that you are, that you want to always have super interesting, intriguing conversations. But to break it down for people who aren't in a room, like, let's just explain a little bit about why personal experiences do come up. We've talked about this a little bit on the podcast in the context of Me Too and in the context of, like, you know, appropriate workplaces. And it's like, if our workplaces are desperately inappropriate sometimes by nature because they have to be. So can you talk a little bit about why it's important to tell personal stories, or where they get from being a personal story about my date that I went on last night that becomes about the work?
Yeah. There are so many examples of that. And I think one of them is, even I can talk about Katie Keene a little bit. When Roberto and I were developing Katie Keene, I think we really cracked it open when we realized there was a show about being in your 20s and being an artist. And we also thought of it as Riverdale is a coming of age show. And we sort of thought of Katie as a second coming of age. So like stories about when you're in your 20s, when you're a little bit older, you know yourself a little bit more. And we're like, okay, what are those stories? And I think Roberto and I had both sort of had experiences with, for example, like people who were supposed to be your mentors and turned out not to be. And that's sort of one of the stories in the Katie Keene pilot, with Katie and her boss. So that's one example of something personal that ends up landing on screen. But I also, Roberto was a playwright in New York City in his 20s. And that's sort of what the story of Katie Keene is. They live in Washington Heights and they share an apartment, and Josie literally sleeps in the living room on the pullout where everyone has to walk through. And we've all sort of had that experience of you're broke. You have not broken through and you've not gotten your foot in the door in your career yet. You're single, and it's sort of the best time of your life. It's sort of that romantic time of your life. And it's such a personal story for, I feel like I've lived that life. I feel like a lot of us have lived that life. And that's sort of an example of something that we've all been through. And we can share those specific stories in the room. And I think in many ways, they're universal.
Well, we talk a lot about specificity is universal. So to take that one step further, not that I'm pitching you what is already in the pilot, but for example, yeah, if you say, oh, I was sleeping on the couch in the apartment with my friends and, I don't know, they had stolen the sheet that I was using as a blanket because they were having sex. And so then I was like, do I take it down and then they have no door, or do I, you know, sleep here without a blanket? Like, the more specific, the more everybody goes, oh yeah, I've had that weird experience, which is how you wind up telling these stories about your life.
For sure. And I love that. It's like, it's funny. It's going back to that dinner conversation, going back to the specificity of pitches, something that Roberto always says, and something that I've started saying as well, the stories really accumulate in the room. Sometimes you go in day one and you're like, okay, this is the story. Or sometimes you go in and you're like breaking and you're on like scenes, you're like breaking, okay, we're on scene seven. You're like, oh no, this is what the story is. And then once you know what it is, people sort of start pitching all these details. And like you just mentioned, Duane, like that can be a pitch on a scene when someone wakes up. Like, what are all those delicious details? What's all that specificity? How do we make this richer? How do we make this deeper?
You've mentioned Roberto a few times, but I don't think we gave like his full name and who he is.
Yes. Roberto Aguirre Sacasa is a very talented writer who I met on my first season of Supergirl. And our offices actually shared a wall. And every time Roberto had a call while he was developing Riverdale, that was the year he was developing Riverdale into a pilot, I sort of listened in on every single call he had. So I felt like I was really engaged in all of the Riverdale pilot process. And I was so interested. And then one day I asked him if I could read the pilot. And I remember reading it and I was like, I am obsessed with this show. I'm obsessed with these characters. I felt like it was something that had a pulse. And it was so deep. And I'm like, I really couldn't believe what I was reading. It felt like something really special. So when I had the opportunity to work with him on the show, I sort of jumped over from Supergirl to Riverdale, which was easy enough because they're both in the Berlanti camp. So that was good. And sort of we've been working together ever since, which is it's been great. And Roberto's tremendously talented. His first room out in L.A. was on Big Love. So he tells lots of great stories.
Excuse about me. I didn't know Big that. Love. You know, that's one of my top two favorite shows of all time.
Yeah, mine too. I'm obsessed with Big Love, and he was on it for 3 years, I think. Yeah,
Big Love was way ahead of its time.
Yeah, agree.
If it was on now, it would be like it would be The Americans. Oh, I had no idea. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, I think we could talk for hours about rooms and staffing and whatnot, but I just want to go towards something that you said about having a diverse room, and that means lots of things. And we can get into all those things. But I can see how people might think if you talk about, oh, Katie Keene opens in Washington Heights and somebody who's an artist and so forth. And yes, I'm thinking of the opening song from In the Heights, obviously. But I can see how people might think, oh, so you want all people who have lived in Washington Heights or Brooklyn or worked in publishing or whatever. And that's not necessarily the case, right?
No, I don't think that's the case at all. I think if someone's done that, great. But it's also, I think the idea of diversity is something that we love about Katie Keene as a show is that there's diversity in our cast and in the casting, but there's also a diversity of characters. These are four people in their 20s, like our four leads on the show are sort of four people who are pursuing very different passions, and sort of everybody on the show, even the guys, they all have a dream and they're all pursuing something very different. So it's nice you get to go to these different quadrants of like fashion, drag, Broadway, music, all of these worlds that Roberto and I are both obsessed with, and they have these strong engines. So when we're looking for diversity in a room, it's not just that one thing. It's people who are passionate about all of these worlds and want to tell stories within these quadrants, I call them. But then, the other nice thing is really it is a family show. It's the heart of the show is when all of these friends come back all together in the apartment and pregame before they go out or talk about their wins or their losses and that is the heart of the show when the friends are all together in the apartment. So we want to hear from people who have had that experience as well. It's another touchstone for the show is Rent. Which is about a community, right? A community of artists, which is something that we're obsessed with. I know that, Duane.
I want to like keep going on this diversity thing because, of course, I think the audience is becoming much more and more tuned to the kinds of stories that they're getting and who gets to tell these stories. Whereas, of course, in the past, we all know who was telling the stories in Hollywood, who was putting them on TV. The immediate example I want to give is Game of Thrones, which right now we are kind of in the tornado, the vortex of it's just about to end. Perhaps by the time this airs, it will have ended. And a lot of people have pointed out that the reason why through the seasons, the women of the show have been done dirty is because there weren't often any women in those rooms. In fact, some seasons, I think, of Game of Thrones, there was only one woman in the room. And then in subsequent seasons, after the backlash and after the criticism, the showrunners, the writers have tried to correct.
Although there certainly are rarely, if ever, female directors on that show.
Yeah.
And it's maybe more of a director-influenced show than some.
Mm-hmm.
It's a smaller room if there is a room. So, I would concur that that's a persistent issue.
I would say that my favorite all-time episode of Game of Thrones was actually directed by a woman, and it did not, that episode did not do its women dirty, like, you know, to give you. However, my point is, in a room, do you ever, like, you're, you know, the way I fetishize and envision it is you guys are all in a bubble. You're coming up with the story. It's great that, like, everybody gets to chime in, but have you ever, outside of the bubble later after the show has aired, been like, we did miss that?
I think that's you raised such a good point, and I think I would say absolutely. I think we're always learning and we're always listening to our audience and we're always evolving. And I think the second that we would stop learning, I think we'd be in trouble. I think that's so important. And I wouldn't say that fans and audience feedback sort of drives our storytelling, but I would say that we are always listening and we really value fans and we really value what's happening in the world. And I think that always comes into our conversations in the room in terms of how we shape stories and in terms of how we love all our characters, and what we put them through has to be about character and has to respect our characters as well. That's always really, really important to us. So it's always a fine line of like what's dramatic, what's interesting, but what also respects these people that our fans have come to love.
Well, you know, you talked about lessons learned from earlier shows or earlier seasons. And I think I've talked to you about a situation where years ago on Degrassi, there was a junior position that was open and there was somebody who was sort of a de facto understood person to get this job. They were qualified, they were personable, everybody liked them. And when our showrunner, Brendan, who we've referenced often, met that person and agreed that they were qualified and personable and whatever, he decided he wasn't going to hire that person. And the rationale was, well, we have too many of that person already. They had a certain profile, they were of a certain type and lived in the same neighborhood as and had maybe the same interests as and the same opinions as people who were already in the room. And so his point and his goal was, let's diversify so that we have different perspectives on those characters so that we don't become too much of a bubble. When you talk about lessons to carry forward, that's one I always try to remember, is that it is easy when you're talking about staffing to be like, this person is great, everybody likes them, they're qualified, whatever. But do they also bring, as you point out, something that's totally new or something we don't have?
Yeah. And the bubble thing is really interesting. And I'm glad you brought it up. Like when I think back to important moments in the room, moments that sort of shifted our season in important ways or our characters in important ways, I think it's moments when writers pitch something that sort of stepped outside the bubble and we're like, but what about this? And that sort of speaks to us being able to step out, and it's important too. I'm glad you brought that up. It's really interesting.
So, you know, we talked about how you and Duana met. You guys were in a room together on Degrassi. Obviously, both of your careers have evolved. So can you talk about the transition in being somebody who is in a room and then becoming somebody who leads a room? You're showrunning now. Katie Keene is your latest showrunning feather, I guess. Is that the expression?
Sure, we can take that, yeah.
I as a person who isn't in the writing community for like scripted, I always have an idea that showrunners are, you know, the models in the media that we have of showrunners are Ryan Murphy and Shonda Rhimes, where, you know, they are their own juggernauts and they run their rooms. But there are all kinds of different showrunners, yeah? Like you create your story, you pitch your story, you run the show. And then there are showrunners who are very experienced and they get hired by the network or the production company to run a show, I don't know, alongside somebody. So can you talk about your experience and like first evolving as someone who writes in a room to leading a room and then, you know, showrunner culture to in general?
For sure. What we were saying earlier, I feel like we're really formed by some of our early room experiences. And I felt like Duane and I were very lucky to have very positive early room experiences. Brendan York was our showrunner on Degrassi, and he had such a strong, he just was a strong leader and really listened to every pitch and when it came time to sort of take the reins, he took the reins and it was felt like a very collaborative experience. And I think every showrunner that you work with, you sort of learn from. You learn what you want to do, you learn what you don't want to do. And I feel like I've been fortunate to work with many great showrunners. Emily Andrus on Lost Girl. In terms of the transition, I sort of had a strange situation. I had finished one season on Lost Girl, which was so much fun with Emily, And then I went to LA to do the Schitt's Creek season one room, which was also really fun. That was led by Dan and Eugene. And then sort of towards the end of the Schitt's Creek season one room, I got a call from Lost Girl saying, we're picked up for a fifth and final season. Do you want to come back? And I was like, I don't think so. I think I live in LA now. And Vanessa Piazza at the time said, well, do you want to come back and run it? And I didn't even hear that because I just didn't process it. And I remember it was like maybe 6 hours later, I was going to bed and I was literally pulling up the covers and I was like, wait, Vanessa said, do you want to run it? And I sort of thought about that for a second. I was like, maybe that's something I need to try. So I felt like I got an opportunity to run a room early on, and it was a terrifying thing. But I'm glad I did it. I learned so much that season. I felt like I was sort of at showrunner school, and I had an amazing room of writers that year as well. So I had sort of a strange transition. But I loved leading a room, and then I moved out to LA, and now sort of on Riverdale, it's sort of a really collaborative process again, because like I said, those writers are amazing. So I've gotten to do it again, and it's going to be fun to do it with Katie Keene as well. So I think what it comes down to is you want to be passionate about the stories you're telling. And I think the second that you're not is when you might be in a little bit of trouble. And I've been fortunate, I feel, with Lost Girl, with Riverdale and Katie Keene, I feel like these are stories I kind of need to tell. And you get so caught up in your career sometimes with what's next. But I think it's so important to sort of lower the noise and take a step back. And you're like, what stories do I want to tell? What do I want to be doing? And I feel very fortunate that I feel like I'm telling exactly what I want to be telling right now, which is great.
It's so interesting that you talk about that, because you talked about showrunners who create shows or showrunners who are hired to shepherd other shows. And actually, there's a woman I got to hear, Ayanna Floyd Davis, speak a couple of weeks ago. She's the showrunner of the second season of The Chi. And she used a word that I love, that you're going to love. She called it matriculation. She talked about the importance of writers matriculating up through the ranks, and that's often a third path, right? That you kind of grow up on a given show, and then somebody says, okay, you know this show very well because you've been here so long, now you take it. And certainly that's something that happens in Shondaland. I think in, do we say Berlanti Land? What do we say?
Yeah, I think Berlanti Land's good.
Yeah.
The Berlanti Camp? That's what I say.
Berlanti Camp? Okay. But that's a very popular other sort of path, right? Is to kind of grow up under somebody, mm-hmm. and then they say, okay, here are your brains. And maybe...
Absolutely.
So can you describe your style personally a little bit? Are you super regimented? Do you like timed bathroom breaks, or are you a little looser? What's your story?
I want to talk about the matriculation a little bit. Is that okay? Can we stay
Yeah, of course.
And talk about that? I'm so... fascinated by that, and I think it's so important, and I learned so much from, like I said, all the past showrunners I've worked with, and from Roberto on a daily basis, and I continue to learn. And I've seen writers sort of who started off as writer's assistants or Roberto's assistants, or even our script coordinators from season one of Riverdale, who are now full-on writers in the room, who are breaking amazing stories and writing amazing scripts and shouldering story in the room. So it's been amazing to see people grow into these roles, and people who start off as assistants sort of blossom into amazing writers in the room and become invaluable, truly. Even mid-level sort of growing up into that position. So it is something that I think is so important, and the idea of mentoring young writers and making sure that they have a voice and making sure that they get to do lots of writing, I think is such an important part of the process.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So on our show, while as we've talked about showrunners and as we've like moved through how Me Too affected Hollywood and how it affected writers' rooms and cultures behind shows and the Time's Up movement, we also have discussed leadership and management. And who was the showrunner who used to be a hospital administrator?
Glenn Mazzara.
Right. And so on one episode, we talked about how he said very few showrunners who are essentially managers in this business have management experience. And for him, because he was a hospital administrator, he was able to apply some of that skill set to an artistic environment. So I wanted to ask, in your transition from being in the room to leading a room, how you're assessing your own management skills and how you're finding being a manager and whether or not those two roles, artist versus manager, are ever in conflict and how you have been able to marry those two sides of yourself.
I love this question. I think that management is a really important part of the room. And I think the most important part of it is communication. And something that I think I want everyone to know at all times in any room I work in is that the lines of communication are always open. We always want to hear from writers if they want to be doing more of something or less of something. But if a writer is passionate about something specific, we or I want to hear what that is. And I will do my best to make sure that that writer is doing more of that. In terms of my style, I think I'm like I said, I'm always learning minute to minute. It's funny making developing Katie Keene with Roberto and then producing the pilot and then being on set and then going through the post process on it. I feel like I learned something new every 5 minutes. I felt like truly I was at pilot camp and I had the time of my life, and I think I'll continue to learn as I enter the room for Katie. I think that's so important. So I guess what I'm saying is I'm not one of those showrunners who's stepping into this saying I know everything, but I'm one of those people who I think I'm ready to take on the challenge and hear from everybody in the room and make it a collaborative, creative process and be a strong, fearless leader to all these new writers that are stepping on board.
Well, there's the other part of showrunning too, of course, which is that you're running the room, and writers who are coming up have been mostly in the room. Each show does it differently. But then all of a sudden you're also in budget meetings and in casting and in wardrobe. And I don't know if you know that quote from Tina Fey. She said that the showrunner's job is to police creativity, that when you ask wardrobe, say, for a red shirt, and they bring in 10 shirts that range from coral to fuchsia, and they're like, but this one has this embellishment, and this is this, and this is that, and you have to kind of crush their dreams and say, actually, just what we need is a plain red shirt. Can you talk about parts of that that are hard for you or that you have learned to work around? Or
yeah, I think the pace of television, you learned very early on that it's either a yes or a no. Like, it's like, you need to move forward. It's like, no, not the fuchsia, the red, let's go. Like, you sort of have to make the decision and move forward. I think that's a really important part of the process. But also, you have these amazing professionals and these artists who are part of the team who are making the show, whether it's the production designer or the costume designer, and you always want to hear from them. But sometimes there comes a time when it's like, no, we need the red shirt. Let's get the red shirt. Let's make sure it fits well. Let's make sure it's broken down and looks aged. It's not the first time that they've worn it. No creases, that sort of thing. And you just sort of have to make sure that what your vision is what's being captured on the day. And it's a collaborative process, and there are lots of people involved and lots of gears. And I think the most important thing that I've learned is that the yes or the no thing, and there's not a lot of time for maybe, you know, if you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think that's actually a really great point. Like, decisiveness, for better or for worse, is the only way forward.
There's not a lot of time for maybe is
great.
Should be on a t-shirt.
Yeah.
And another fun, I don't know if something, a show like Riverdale and even Roberto's show Sabrina, they're very beautiful shows, and they're very curated and very layered, and it's very important that the shows are beautiful to us. So we are very hands-on, and we are a writer-driven show, and there are always writers on set, and it's the collaborative process to see how all the departments sort of get excited and passionate, and everyone feels like they're contributing to something and making something special, is also a really satisfying thing. When sort of someone on set, someone on the crew, or one of the writers says this is our show, and that they have ownership of the show, that's really important to us as well, and is a really satisfying part of the process to see people get excited about the work and feel ownership and feel proud.
When did you know you were good?
Oh God, that's a hard question. I don't like questions like that. I am one of those people who, my stepdad's a lawyer, and one day he said to me, "You're only as good as your last file," which is such like a lawyerly thing to say. And I really took it to heart, and I continue to take it to heart till this day. I'm sort of always looking forward, and I don't look back that often. Or I'm always looking forward. So I'm always challenging myself to grow and to be better. And I think that's where my head is always the what's next, and how can this be really special, and how can this be really, really good? And thinking less about me and myself and if I'm good or not. It's like, how do I make this special? Does that make sense?
It does. And the reason why I worded it that way is because I think the writer's question, the equivalent writer's question to that question is, when did you find your voice? And it actually, that question gives you room to move and squirm, which is what you've been doing. But the equivalent of good for a writer is finding your voice, having confidence in your voice. And you have one, obviously. I mean, that's established. You're running a show. You have run shows. But when did you feel that you had one, that you had a point of view, that it was worth sharing?
I love the question worded that way, because I can remember exactly when that happened. And I really felt like it was on Degrassi really, really early on. We were talking about sort of second coming of age stories. One of my second coming of age stories was when I was working at CTV. I was working in the drama department, and I was offered to be an executive, the executive in charge of production on Flashpoint at the time, which felt like a big job for me in my early 20s. And then I was also offered to be the coordinator on Degrassi that very first season. And I took the risk. I took the job that didn't pay anything, and it ended up paying off. And I that very first year, I got to sort of tell a story that was really important to me on Degrassi, which was about a closeted football player who was sneaking off to the woods to hook up with one of his previous campmates. And I remember the showrunner at the time was not Brendan; it was another showrunner. She didn't believe in the story and was angry that we were telling it. And I remember she sort of snapped at me, and she's like, "But they're children," was what she said to me. And I sort of, this is like, "They're children." I'm like, "Oh, first of all, he's a teenager. He's fine. And he's with another teenager. Everything's okay." But I remember I sort of pushed through, and I pitched the episode to Linda. And Linda was like, "This is amazing. Let's do it." And I sort of felt like that was my first time where I believed in a story, where we were telling sort of a coming of age story that was personal, that felt like that a story that needed to be told. And it was interesting to see, like, oh, I have a voice. I have something to say. And the creator of Degrassi believes that I should write this. And that was sort of a very smooth first script process for me. That was really fun. And I was like, okay, maybe I can keep doing this. And I did. Yeah. Is that a good story? Are we allowed to tell stories like this?
I love that 100% story.
We tell those stories, and you told it very perfectly with all the, you walked a beautiful line there. So, but here's something that's interesting about that. And I think, I think we could have a whole other conversation about the blessing and curse of an easy first script, but that's another time.
Oh yeah, they get harder and harder.
The first one is always like a nice, blissful, easy orgasm, and then you're like, why aren't they all like this?
I think you told me this once, Duane. You said, the more you know, the harder it gets. And I think about that all the time. You said that to me, and I could not agree more. The more you know, the harder it gets.
Why do you think that is?
I think that you've done something, and then when you go to do the next thing, it's like you've accumulated more knowledge on what it takes to make something great. And I think you're just always trying to push to make something better than your last thing, and I think it just gets harder and harder.
I mean, I don't disagree, but I'm very proud to know I had such like bon mots coming out. but speaking of that, so you have done a number of shows that have been successful, but Riverdale was like a cultural juggernaut. Like Riverdale arrived fully formed and it was instantly, a part of the conversation, and as you pointed out, had a tone and had a look and all that kind of thing. Are there pressures? There must be, but what are the pressures that are unique to working on something that is so big, so fast?
I think the pressure is always to never be like, okay, well, this is a third season show. It's never sort of resting on the laurels. It's sort of like, okay, we're entering a new season of this. How do we make this the best season of the show yet? How do we give our amazing cast new material, stuff to dig into that's fresh and exciting and challenging? Same goes with the crew and every department. It's sort of like, what are the new stories to tell and how do we make this the best season possible? Is the pressure, I think, and it's sort of the challenge that we're always holding ourselves to make sure that we're sort of not resting and sort of always pushing forward and driving forward and trying to make something special.
And to that end, can you talk a little bit about like maybe room mechanics in terms of a thing that you do experience in the writer's room, but that I think doesn't get talked about as much is when two characters who have no business being together have crazy chemistry, or the two leads that you cast opposite each other kind of fizzle. You know, whether you want to be general or specific, like you can tell us if your first reaction is, oh, fuck. But can you talk a little bit about that?
No, I love what you're saying. I think it's so important to watch for chemistry and where the sparks are on screen. And I think we have sort of put people together and it's really worked, and we've seen what that does, and there is undeniable chemistry amongst many of our cast members, and we do watch that, and that is very important. You almost can't be super rigid in television. You have to be willing to sort of learn and evolve, and it's like, this isn't working, how do we pivot from this? Okay, the audience really isn't responding to this storyline, how do we end it in a surprising, satisfying, deep way and start something new? I think is something that we're always looking out for.
Was there ever a character who was not intended to be a thing, and either the actor arrived and really killed it and you made them a thing, or, well, let's focus on the positive.
Well, no,
yeah. No, yeah, let's focus on the positive. It's funny, we shoot in Vancouver, and there are so many amazing local Vancouver actors that we've cast on Riverdale that were just brought in sort of as episodic actors, but really popped and shined and had great chemistry with a lot of our characters. Someone like Fangs and Sweet Pea are amazing. Vanessa Morgan, who plays Tony Topaz, who is another Canadian actor, she came in to be someone who goes to Southside High and had scenes with Jughead, and she was a serpent. And then we ended up pairing her with Madeleine Petch, who plays Cheryl Blossom, and the chemistry there was undeniable, and they've sort of broken out as one of the favorite couples on the show. And Vanessa's sort of been is one of our series regulars now. So yes, that definitely does happen. It is a thing. Also, people who we sort of brought on for one scene. There's a scene where Veronica's sort of courting a bunch of potential suitors as like business suitors, and then one of the young actors who played the character of Elio is somebody who was great, and he keeps on coming back because he's just good. So we're always watching out for people who are good that sort of populate the world. And yeah, I think there have definitely been success stories.
Quick follow-up, since you mentioned shooting in Vancouver and since you mentioned Vanessa Morgan is Canadian, but of course you are in a writer's room in LA and you have been in LA for many years. Is there anything that you have pitched that people look at you strange and you realize it's a Canadianism? Or
all the time.
Tell.
Oh my God. I get teased a lot for being the Canadian in the room, but that's okay. I can roll with that. I'm trying to think of something specific where people are like, huh? It happens kind of like regularly.
Like, I'll give you an example that I heard recently. I was listening I was listening to Seth Rogen, who's Canadian, on the Dax Shepard podcast. And Seth was telling some story about, at lunch in high school, we would go wherever. And Dax Shepard said, right, and you sneak off campus. And Seth said, no, you just go. And that was a sort of 10-minute digression, because I guess in a lot of schools in the U.S., it's you can't leave. You would be, you'd be in trouble with the truancy officer or whatever it is, like just cultural differences that you don't realize are different until you talk about them.
Yeah. Oh, there are so many. I also feel like it's Canadian for me. And then I'm also from Quebec. So it's like this double, like I'm like, so it's like Cégep is like a word that people have never heard.
In fairness, I also laugh at your Cégep stories.
Yeah. Like Cégep is weird. I'm trying to think of other things, but like my first week in the room, I was the Supergirl room. I was like, I think I was like talking, some people were talking about the WGA and I'd be like, but the WGC would protect you. And everyone sort of looked at me being like, you're not in Canada anymore. So I sort of like, you need to evolve. There are a number of things. I can't think of any specific ones right now. On Supergirl, I was like, I guess like sort of like proudly still writing with my U's. And I remember I overheard the showrunner, Ali Adler, tell the script coordinator being like, and watch out for Michael's Canadian spelling. And I was like, ooh.
What?
Yikes.
No, but why would that be a thing?
Well, it just is like, you're asking me like, why is that a problem?
Yeah.
Because when you're down to the wire, and everything has to be checked, there are a million things the coordinator has to do. It's just one more thing on the list to do a search and replace for every Canadian word. And I would imagine if that
But how would that be an obstacle? Like, is there a person out there who would be like, I can't read this line because there's this weird phantom you that I've never seen before.
Okay, so now I'll tell you, like, yes, agents will tell you, yes, that's an obstacle. That you have to change all your spelling, right? Like, I don't want to speak for you, but that's something you've been told too, right? Take the Canadianisms out of your script.
I don't even know. That was the first time I had heard it, and I was like chilled to the bone. So I've been like very, very diligent about my Canadian spelling ever since. And my iPhone still tells me that when I spell something American, they're like, it tells me that it's wrong. So I feel like my iPhone's keeping me in check. Like, it's keeping me Jenny from the block. One other thing about room culture that I just want to mention, I don't know if this feels like a weird sidebar, but something that I feel like is important is that our rooms are sort of title blind. Like, we're sort of title blind in the room, and hierarchy is not an important thing in the room. And just because someone is, for instance, a higher level writer, it doesn't mean that their pitch has more value or that we necessarily want to hear from them more. It's sort of like we're all writers in the room and we're all working together to make this episode special and great. And every good pitch is a good pitch. It doesn't matter who it comes from in the room, if that makes sense. So that's another thing, that some rooms are a little more hierarchical.
Yeah.
Is that the word?
It is. I'm glad that you mentioned it because I don't actually think that's something we've talked about. We do often talk about the writer's room as though it's a collective. But in both Canada and the U.S., but I think more overtly in the U.S., there are kind of stair steps. Each year that you write has a new title. And so in theory, a room is staffed with, this is not exact, but in theory, a room is staffed with one person from each stair step or each level. And so that's what you're talking about, that there are some rooms where the person in the number two position, their pitch has more weight than the person in the number six position.
Yeah. Yeah, that's not the case on Riverdale, and I think the same thing will be for Katie, is that we all think of ourselves as writers, and we're sort of all a team, and that's sort of how the room functions, is that a pitch is valid from anybody who's in the room, including our amazing writer's assistants who are in there taking notes. It's like, if you've got something to say, we want it, we need it. It's like, sort of jump in, you know?
But my follow-up to that would be, you come up with these stories, this is the story you want to tell, but ultimately you have to take it to the network, right? So is it the showrunner who has to fight for the story, who has to advocate for it, if there are any concerns?
Great question, yeah. So every step of the process, the studio and network are heavily involved, so and are great partners. And so when we deliver the first document, which is the story area, we do a notes call. And then when we deliver the script, we also do a notes call. And the showrunner for Riverdale, in Riverdale's case, Roberto was on every single call. And it's we sort of have a dialogue and we talk about notes and we sort of discuss stuff and we make sure that stuff is as good as it can be. And a lot of people sort of groan at the notion of notes, but we really do look at it as an opportunity to, it's another chance to make this better. It's another chance to deepen something. It's another chance for us to take a look at it. And we're always sort of kicking the tires and making sure that things are as good as they can be right up until the point where we're shooting them. Is there one more good line? Is there one more fun thing we can put in here? Is there one more image that we can try to work in? And any opportunity to do that, including the steps of the notes process, are important to that.
I think that's the ideal situation, and obviously you have that, and it's what everybody strives for in whatever industry they work in. I mean, we obviously have been focusing only on screenwriting here for this episode, but I think you can apply that, the notes thing, to any industry. Having to get approval or buy-in or collaboration from all levels of the organization to be as general as possible. That said, even I, and I think even the public, have heard about stories where the network has pushed back, that they haven't been happy. I mean, I think one of the most recent well-known examples of this has been an episode on Blackish that was completely shelved, which was an episode about Colin Kaepernick and the effect it had, and Kenya Barris wanting it this way, and the network basically saying, no, we can't do that. Have you ever come up against something like that before?
There were instances, I would say, where we had dialogues with the studio or network where they pushed back on storylines, and we also fought for storylines. And I think the decisions that were always made in our case specifically were always for the better of the show. And it's funny, it's sometimes we find ourselves holding our own work to the fire in a way as much as the studio network does. So sometimes the studio network will sign off on something, and then we're the ones who are asking ourselves, is this really the right story we should be telling? And it's like, okay, let's take this back to the room. Maybe this isn't the right story. How do we make this deeper or better? But I can't think of a specific instance where there was like a pushback. I often think about Degrassi, and I think about that Manny episode. There was an abortion episode before my time that T. Nick the N at the time didn't air right away. Do you remember that, Duenna?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. They had been on board with all of the elements of the show up to then, including the episode where, of course, that character, who I think was 14 at the time, gets pregnant, but they couldn't
come to, they couldn't in good faith air that episode in their minds where she had an abortion at that time, which I think was 2003.
Yeah. God. Yeah, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah, or 2004. And eventually they did, and it's just indicative of the culture changes, right? Things that are unacceptable become more acceptable. Yeah. I guess, though, in that vein, and this is something that you wanted to talk a lot about, you talk about audience response and there's network response, and there, you know, one of the dirtiest words in TV fandom is like fan service, right? Like being, doing a show that is for the fans too much, but then it's also, mm-hmm. if you do a show that's not enough for the fans, then you do no longer have a show. Funny that. So talk about walking that line a little bit.
Yeah, it's such a, we live in a different time where there's such an awareness of all that. I have this belief that if we ever were to do any kind of fan service, I think the fans would be hyper aware of it and would turn on the show and be like, this is fan service. Like, I think that it would sort of crack the show a little bit in a bad way. I think what's important is always to look at the characters and tell story through character. And I think that's the way to sort of avoid any of that, is just to be truthful to the character. And sometimes when you sort of get caught up in that noise and you're sort of thinking too big picture, too, like, well, how are the fans going to react? Sometimes it's really good to sort of like quiet all that noise and sort of ask the question, okay, like, what would Betty do next? What would Archie, a human being, do next in this situation? And sort of trying not to think about a lot of the external feedback and sort of thinking about this amazing three-dimensional character that's been developed over three seasons now, and it's really being truthful to them and honoring the characters first and foremost is how I personally navigate that, and I think how we navigate that as a room.
Now, you're in a unique position because you're working from source material as inspiration, much like Avengers, where you have already a built-in, I mean, perhaps Archie's a little bit different because, you know, the people who read Archie comics are not like from the 50s or whatever, or the 60s. But, you know, with the Avengers, there's a huge comic book fan base that is looking and mining to the source material for clues, for background, for understanding of the character. You're in a similar kind of environment. So does that have any kind of impact on how you're writing to the show?
The IP for Archie Comics is amazing, and the characters are amazing, and they're such an inspiration. I think they've been an inspiration for the show since the very beginning. It's interesting. The storylines in Archie Comics aren't necessarily driving our plot, because we're sort of, Riverdale's sort of a take on the Archie characters. It's sort of a subversion of the yeah. Archie characters. And we're inspired by all of the characters and the DNA of the comic book characters, and how do we subvert them and three-dimensionalize them. And we're also inspired by relationships. Early on in season one, there were certain couplings that were couplings from the comic books that we brought together. And obviously the Archie Betty Veronica triangle is something that we're always sort of circling and exploring, because that's so true to the comic books, but always looking for a way to do it on Riverdale that's true to these characters in this show. We very often look back to the comics as for inspiration. In terms of it driving story, I don't know if it does, because of the nature of Archie Comics, which are shorter, sort of funnier, anecdotal storylines.
Mm-hmm. And we should be clear that Katie Keene is from that universe as well, yes? Much
yes,
like Sabrina was in that universe.
Yeah, Katie Keene is a really cool comic book. She is a model, and she's an actress in the comic books, and she's very glamorous. And we've sort of reimagined her as a young fashion designer who makes clothes. She makes clothes for herself. She makes clothes for her friends. And the Katie Keene comic books are so beautiful. From the 50s, she was sort of America's queen of pinups and fashions. And if you sort of get your hands on some of the older issues, a lot of them have paper dolls. Were you guys obsessed with paper dolls growing up?
I think I love the idea of paper dolls, like no, books, like, but I never knew where to get them
because I was obsessed with the show Paper Dolls.
I don't know that show either.
Yeah, there was like a TV show called Paper Dolls, and it didn't last very long.
Do you mean Living Dolls?
No, Paper Dolls. I will look it up while you continue.
I was obsessed with Paper Dolls. We always had like the cutouts. It would basically be like someone in their underwear, and then you fold like a dress onto them. That was really big in the Katie Keene comics. You can cut out the clothes. Another cool thing about the Katie comics is that young readers or any readers could mail in their designs, and then the artists would put those designs on Katie in the comics and sort of give shout outs to the fans mailed in their designs, which is really cool. Yeah.
Let me just educate you two young people. Paper Dolls was an American television series that debuted in 1984. It didn't last long, but please let me read you the cast list. Morgan Fairchild, the end. Morgan Fairchild, Nicolette Sheridan. Yes, that's why I was obsessed with it. And it was about New York's fashion industry. The show centered on top modeling agency owner Racine, played by Morgan Fairchild. Anyway, yes, young people.
This sounds amazing.
FYI.
This sounds amazing.
Okay, get on it, Netflix. I just want to say, while we're talking in this area of where story comes from, and I know that, you know, we could talk for hours, but you probably have other things in your life, but when we're talking about fans and what they like or source material or whatnot, one of the things you talk about, things that come from earlier showrunners or shows, one of the things that I've said that you've really liked about, you know, is a kind of a governing principle. And I want to know your reaction to it. We talk about giving people and fans or audiences what they need and not what they want. And that to me is a Brendan Yorkism as well. And is that ever tough or always easy?
It's easy when you're just trying to you're trying to focus on the character. And I think that people watch the show because it's dramatic, and people watch the show because there's conflict. I think if in the ideal world where nothing happened to any of these characters and everything was fine in their lives and all the relationships were sort of unbreakable, I think the drama would escape from the show like a punctured balloon, and we'd be in trouble. So I think part of just being human is having all those cracks and that messiness and ups and downs. And I feel like it's just trying to provide deep stories for these characters, and that is maybe what the audience needs, maybe what they don't need, but I think keeping the drama is so important. And I think fan service, like I said, sort of deflates some of that.
So on the subject of characters, a difficult topic, but we lost a character this year. So in staying with the work, on the work side, how do you handle that? And how do you move ahead?
Yeah, it's such a tremendous loss to everyone, to the show. And I think we'll all really miss Luke. And I think the show will miss Luke. The only way to sort of move forward in something like this is to honor Luke as much as we can, and to move forward with Luke in mind, it's something that's very hard to move forward from, and it's also just thinking of Archie as a character, as crazy as some of our storytelling gets, and as gonzo as it gets, and as baroque as it gets, the safe space on Riverdale was when you were in that kitchen with Archie and Fred. Like, those were the scenes which sort of grounded things and slowed stuff down in a good way. So we'll miss that tremendously. And then we'll definitely feel that loss. And in terms of how we move forward, like I said, it's all about honoring Luke and honoring the character of Fred. And in terms of how Archie's going to move on, it's funny, before any of this happened, we were planning to bring Molly Ringwald back, who plays Archie's mom, Mary Andrews, for a storyline. And then she's so great, and she stuck around, and she sort of stepped in as in a sort of maternal role for Archie, which was great. And hopefully there will be more of that moving forward.
It's one of those heartbreaking, but also kind of amazing reasons why we do this type of a job, which is to say, this is the kind of thing you can't predict in life. And then you sort of, you talked about Archie as a living, breathing human being. And going, this is a scenario that we didn't predict for the character, fictionally. And going, okay, well, now we are reeling, but also that character is reeling. And figuring out how he moves from there is what makes a show kind of relevant in the moment, right? There's a reason it's not a book with a finite ending.
Yeah, that's sort of the wonder of that's what makes television so special, is that you get to continue to tell these stories with these characters and through all kinds of stuff. How do you move on, and how do you move forward is something that we'll be talking a lot about in our room and beyond, you know?
I think too, it's one of the rare occasions where want and need converge. Like, I'm not sure that there's going to be a pull between what the character needs versus necessarily what the fans want. I think all of that is just the same, is like still a creative challenge. And yet you don't have to worry, for lack of a better, like, of course there are many bigger things to worry about, but you don't have to worry about the pull there.
Well, I think that comes back to your point, Michael, about just sort of human instincts and people going like, yeah, what does a living, breathing character need in this moment? And that's where TV does its best work, and where characters become the kind of totems that people relate to. Even though everybody watching TV ever knows it's fictional, when they see a story that really touches them, it's because it was written by real people having real experiences, mm-hmm. and acted by real people who have had those real experiences. So those can be they can be transcendent moments, even though they often come out of pain.
Well, speaking of
Absolutely.
That, I think that, you know, the writer's life, more than maybe any other profession, needs life. Like, you need to have life in order to be able to inform story and characters and bring that sense of reality into the room. So
yeah.
Let's talk about your life.
Oh my God.
What has success done to your life?
You know, it's wonderful. I work a lot, but work is great. And then I have an amazing partner, Matt, and we spend a lot of time together. He's my family here in Faye. I see friends as often as I can. We try to get to the beach. There's a dog beach called Rosie's Beach where Faye could be off leash, and she's not a runner, but when she's on Rosie's Beach, like, she runs, and it's pretty amazing. That's like a moment of grace. You know, when Oprah talks about like wow moments, or like moments of like wonder when you see God, like that's like seeing God, is like Faye running.
Spoken like a true dog lover. Like, and people who don't have dogs don't understand this. Like, they, you know, I feel like, because I don't have children, I have dogs. It is that moment of divinity in your life when your dog does something that just dogs are supposed to do, run on the beach.
Well, dogs and dogs stay pure in a way that children are wonderful people, but children become kids, and then kids become teenagers, and dogs stay in that pure state mm-hmm. all of the time. I would say, Michael, that over the years, you know, obviously you love Matt, and that's very clear, but I feel like you burst into bloom of love when Faye came into your life. Like, you just became a heart beating externally all the time when she arrived.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. She, when I first got here, when I first landed in LA, as we all know, I think transitions are always hard and it's really vulnerable when you start a new job and a new world and no one knows you and you have to prove yourself and all of that stuff. And like, it's, and I was so in my head about all of it that when Faye came into our lives, it was like, oh, there is something external, like this womanly dog that needs to be walked and fed and taken care of. And it was like, oh, it's nice that something is not about to sort of externally have to take care of something. It was it really, really helped a lot. And I think it's so important to continue to cultivate things on the outside of work that require time and attention, because as you say, we have to live full lives in order to write full lives and full characters. And yeah, that's something that I have to continue to try to prioritize moving forward. And I love going to the movies here. I love being in LA. I love going to the record store and looking at old records. I just went last week and like, I really went crazy for like, I went into like the Wainwright, like I Kate and Anne McGarrigle. I got like every album they had. I got all of like the Ludwig Wainwright albums and like tons of Prince and a Tommy record. Just that's fun for me.
And you put them on, like, are you going to have a turntable in the office or do you put them on at home or?
That's at home. I mean, I would love a turntable at the office, but step by step, you know.
Keep that for home life, to have something else, right?
Yeah.
So I think what I wanted to end on with you is, as you become more successful, how will you navigate all the great things that will continue to come at you, being that you're only one person, you only have a finite amount of time. In that time, you also want to have a life outside of the work so that you can do good work. I think that's part of show your work too, is as you become successful, what are the things you say no to and when do you say yes?
That's such a good question. I was sort of having this conversation with a friend yesterday, and I think I feel like I've reached a point in my life where I've just started to learn and use the word no. And it's been, it's pretty powerful. And like, I hear Oprah talk about it a lot and she talks about the word no and it's, and how it's powerful. And I think that I always, and I think we all have to look within and be like, what stories do we want to tell? What do we want to say? And how do we balance that to make sure that we have full lives as well is important, because you can take on a lot. And we work in a world where people want you to take on a lot. And I'm the type of person who wants to take on a lot, but I think I want to make sure that what I take on is stuff that speaks to me and stuff that I that is important to me.
That's amazing. And it's a masterclass to sit here and listen to you talk about like quiet the noise and focus about what you want to say and do is, I'm taking that home with me. And so it's, I think everybody's going to love that as well.
I'm taking home, there's no time for maybe.
Yeah, for sure. It's either a yes or a no is, I think, maybe the title of the episode.
Yeah.
It's real good.
I love it.
I'm heartbroken because I just realized that before our episode began, you talked about the Degrassi movie, and we didn't ask Michael about a troll. There's a very active troll who is upset about some of the things that happened in that film. So we'll have to follow up with that the next time we talk to him.
But everybody, remember, sometimes there's just no time for maybe.
It's either a yes or a no.
Mm-hmm. And it seems so simple. And then when someone says it, you're like, fuck yeah. Why am I not living my life according to there's no time for maybe?
I mean, that's the joy of doing something like that professionally, where there are a lot of decisions to be made. In your own life, you can kind of waffle and prevaricate. But in that moment, it's either a yes or a no.
I also took home some new information that I hadn't really thought about. Yeah, have your wardrobe people wash the clothes before people wear them so they don't still have like the size sticker on it, you know, is always a good thought.
So fresh off the season finale last week of Riverdale and the season 3 conclusion and leading into Katie Keene, which you all will be watching, think about this podcast and what Michael shared with us.
Thanks so much. And until next time, send us your thoughts, your emails, your tweets. You know we love them all, even when we're fighting, especially when we're fighting.
And check us out wherever you get your podcast. Subscribe to us, leave comments, give us reviews, and always show your work. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.